All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off, broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And tonight, I have an awesome guest. Charles Perallo has the opinion that libertarians should stop being so damn radical. We're going to talk about that. He's the founder of Stop Scrolling Media, and also the founder of beinglibertarian.com. He's also been the campaign manager to Governor Lincoln Chafee during part of his presidential campaign in this last election. Of course, before we get started, if you're watching the live streams, make sure to like and share or start a watch party. And don't forget to send in your comments and ask questions. We do watch those while the show's going on. And also head over to taxationistheft.info and support us. Help us to get this information out there. Everything that you do through that site, whether you're buying these really awesome hats or t-shirts or flags, goes to help our efforts to spread counter-propaganda to end taxation around the world. There's also, if you head over to our YouTube page, there's plenty of extra content, so make sure you head over there and like and subscribe. And now, on to the show. Charles, welcome. How's it going?
How are you doing there, Dan?
Doing pretty good. So, I always want to jump right in, but I also have so many other questions.
Give me any question you want. We're here for a while, so I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, so let's start with Lincoln Chafee. What was that like working on his campaign?
Oh man, that's a great question. And honestly, so you know, the way I got involved with that, with working with Governor Chafee, is I was having dinner with my partner John, who's from Chicago and lives in there. So he was in New York, so we don't get to see each other that often. And he, I saw on Andy Craig's Facebook post, if you know Andy, who's been involved in the LP for a while, and I believe he got 5% running for office in Wisconsin as auditor of the state. And, he said, I didn't expect Lincoln Chafee to join the LP, but glad to see it. And, the party's a little weird, and I don't think always been the most competent thing on the planet. So I was like, a lot of people are going to reach out to Chafee. Let me try to reach out, because I don't want to see some people who are going to just try and scam him for money or give him weird advice or whatever. Because I had a feeling he was running for president, because my partner, John, who's not a political guy, he was like, well, look, no one joins the LP who's a former governor or senator unless they're running for president. So I shoot him a message. And then, for some reason, I end up a week later, I'm at a party at the Profundo nightclub in Queens, and then at the Playboy Club, and I'm out until 7 in the morning. And I see a message at 7 a.m. where I'm about to go to sleep, because I messaged Chafee through Facebook, and I asked him for a phone call, and I just get a message back saying, sure. And it's like, he gave me his email. It's like, let's set up a time this week. So I end up doing a phone call with him and a guy who I'll call my work wife, Jacob Linker, even though with my hair, he always says I'm the wife. And, we end up doing a call. I thought it was going to go for 20 minutes and he was going to say, I'm interested. It ended up being nearly 3 hours. And wow. We talked about the idea of him running for president. And it was a really cool thing because, one thing I can say is I've been interested in politics for a long time. I was, I want to say 24 years old at the time. So to be 24 years old and, talking to a guy who is a former governor and senator, someone who 10 years ago I was researching, that's a really awesome experience to have. And then we asked him to, introduce him to people in the party, because he said we were the first phone call. So I put him on a call with Gary Johnson, put him in a phone call with, not Nick Sarwark, but Daniel Fishman, and a lot of other people who he otherwise wasn't introduced to. And I also gave him some advice on who I thought he should stay away from, who I thought he shouldn't know. I set up his interview with Larry Sharp. And ultimately, he set up the campaign where, I think a couple mistakes happened early on with our involvement. And he ended up hiring Christopher Thrasher, who is the campaign manager to Mike Gravel 08 and John McAfee 2016. And Chris, it wasn't my advice to pick him. I think ultimately a lot of people who saw that campaign and saw like the first kind of 2 months of it or 3 months of it would know that it wasn't off to a very good start. And I ultimately think Chris was a product of that. I don't think he was the best at working with volunteers. I offered to help out writing content for Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, he kind of just gave a lot of no's. And then, you know, it was not at the best process. And the campaign was losing the nomination. It was horrible. Hell, you know, you were running for the campaign. I think there were a couple of state conventions where you were beating Chafee in, you know, the poll. Like, I mean, he was losing every single straw poll. So I that never happened to Gary Johnson a single time in 2016. So, you know, I kind of just reached out to Governor Chafee because I tried reaching through Chris. And, you know, he said that Chafee didn't want to talk about COVID, which I was like, this was in the beginning of COVID. I was just scratching my head, like, what's going on here? So I decided to email him a long email saying, hey, I could work with Chris, but I want to work with you more directly. I recommended the people I was going to make, you know, get on. And it was a 2-page email saying, this is how I think we fix the campaign. And I get a phone call back later that day from Governor Chafee. And I was honestly afraid to answer it. I thought he was going to yell at me and, you know, say that, like, you know, I'm an asshole for proposing this. First words out of his mouth were, everything you said in that email was absolutely correct. And, you know, it was kind of weird to hear, you know, a guy who was a U.S. senator tell you that, just call you up out of the blue. And it was pretty cool to hear that. And him and I ended up speaking for an hour. And next day, I bring in Andrew Reckin, Jacob Linker, and myself, Andrew being a student at University of Pennsylvania Law. And Chafee agrees to make us co-campaign managers and chair us to the campaign. He introduces us to his friend Caswell Cook, who was a city councilman in Rhode Island and was also a member of the Libertarian Party at the time. And we, you know, just start planning things out. We really scale up the social media. And we did it all for free. You know, my belief in politics is that this is a passion for me versus something that I want to make money on. I'm not like the Ron Nielsens of the world who, you know, he was Gary's 2016 campaign manager. And there's a bit of stories with that. So we were doing it all for free. We were raising money. We were, you know, doing well on social media, bagging interviews. We had the Washington Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and Business Insider, 4 interviews booked in one day, which was actually more press than I think anyone in the LP primary got for 2020, besides the, you know, Jorgensen, who became nominee. And we, you know, were doing well, but then, you know, he decides to ultimately, you know, end the campaign. And I think it was a mix of the following. Number one, a lot of damage done early on in the campaign. Number two, yeah, you know, we were kind of struggling on the VP list of coming up with someone the LP would approve, who'd also be able to scale and, you know, be able to get us into the debates, help us get there. And the third thing was his mother just passed away the week before, and I think he was a bit down. But, you know, I still keep a good relationship with Governor Chafee, and I'd actually be interested in seeing him run in 2024, if not him or Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, who, you know, I know him fairly well. He, I think, is, you know, I would say not a ton of interest yet, but there are people in the LP from different backgrounds who've asked him to run. And I think he actually will consider it in the next year or so, and we could see a campaign from him. But yeah, that's the Lincoln Chafee story.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, I got to meet him and talk to him several times at these conventions, and you know, I disagreed with him on a lot of his policy positions, but you know, he's a real nice guy. And it's interesting to see how that works out, because I know, you know, we argue over policies and positions and strategies and all this stuff all the time, and I think, you know, a lot of people are looking for that fight. They're looking for us to just tear into each other. And, you know, before I had met him, that was kind of the plan. Like, oh yeah, like, you know, this guy's not a real libertarian. Let me do what I can do. But, you know, I meet him and like, I realize he's not like a tyrant, like, you know, some of these other guys that, that are, you know, sticking with the Democrat and the Republican Party. So I was like, you know, I'm not just gonna destroy the guy. You know, he's a nice guy. So, it's really interesting to see, you know, how that changes when you kind of see the humanity in these people, when, you know, for a lot of people, they're just faces, or they're just, you know, oh, well, he was the governor of a state or a senator, or, you know, everyone's kind of got these opinions based on what they see about this, and they kind of miss the humanity. And a lot of that is really, you know, I think a lot of people miss out on that because it's like, we understand, like, you know, people look at, well, he was an employee of the state. It's the same as people who look at police and say all cops are bad. Like, not necessarily, yes, they're working for an organization that does a lot of bad things, but, you know, we have to understand a lot of people who join the military, and this is an easy one for people to understand, are not criminal in nature. They're being tricked into this system where they're sent off to, you know, kill other people in these wars that really they know nothing about. They're tricked into believing it's for a good cause and all these other things. And, you know, you kind of lose that that humanity, I think. And I think that's something that's really important, and especially in this time where everybody likes to rage fight on social media over everything. Like, oh, you said this, you're an idiot, and this is why, you know, this is what we get into. So I think that's always really interesting. So, let's see.
Well, yeah, also, so, I'd like to comment a little. Well, hold on. I'd like to comment on a little bit about that regarding Governor Chafee, because one thing about him is that, you know, when I first spoke to him, you know, first phone call, one thing I noticed was he was extremely passionate about anti-war policy in this country. He hated the Iraq War. He is proud that he was the only Republican senator to vote against it. You know, I remember mentioning that Gary Johnson, because I said this to him as a joke, but it was true. You know, Donald Rumsfeld actually lives next door to Governor Gary Johnson in New Mexico. And Chafee goes, ugh, that man's a war criminal. And I hear that and I'm like, you know, Governor Chafee, look, there are issues mainly on economics where I'd say I have disagreements with Governor Chafee. I'm like, you know, he's not a big proponent of nuclear power. I am. I'm for school choice. He's more for strengthening the existing school system. So there are differences that I have with him. But I hear that passion about, you know, foreign policy and what we've done overseas. And I thought there was a great fit with him in the Libertarian Party, very similar to how Tulsi Gabbard is. I'd say that he is Tulsi Gabbard, but much better on budget and the economy versus her, where she definitely is still in kind of the Bernie crew on economics, even though I think she's gotten a little bit better there. But yeah, I thought there was a great synergy. And I actually put Tulsi Gabbard on the VP list. She ended up endorsing Biden. We took her off. But, you know, she was top of the list for a little while.
Yeah, she's pretty interesting, too. And, you know, she was halfway there for me when she said taxation is theft. But then she followed it up with something like when the government taxes too much or something along those lines. Or when you take and you spend it on wasteful programs.
I think it was more about like the wars and her stances there. Yeah. She was. You know, when government spends taxes to hurt people, spends tax money to hurt people, it's theft. And I agree with that. I think I don't know anyone who shouldn't agree with that.
Right. No, that's absolutely theft. But of course, my position is that all taxation is theft. So, but yeah, I think, you know, like I said, and especially since she's been in the military for so long, I think she's definitely kind of been brainwashed into that culture. But I think she does have. I mean, she's called Edward Snowden a hero. She's asked for him to be pardoned. The same for Julian Assange, I believe. And like these types of things, especially coming from somebody in the military, I think is. I mean, that's first of all, that's brave if you're in the military. But I think that's something that needs to be acknowledged. And you know, as long as she's been in there, and as long as she's been brainwashed to the socialist economics of the United States, because that's not Bernie Sanders is kind of an extreme of that, but really we've been living in that system for 100 years or more. So I think for, you know, it's like, this is the thing, it's normal for people to be socialist. That doesn't mean it's right, but it's normal at this point, and that's something we need to change. And yeah, I suppose that wouldn't be the reason for selecting somebody to be the leader of something, but at the same time, that doesn't mean you want to build a wall between you and them. You want to try to bridge that gap, and if you can, educate them on that thing. There was a girl who posted a video a couple days ago on TikTok, and she was holding up like a $20 bill and a $50 bill, and like apparently this thing went viral, and a lot of people were just talking shit and calling her an idiot because she's like, they're the same piece of paper, piece of plastic. This was like, They look like euros. It's the same piece of plastic, but this one's worth more than the other one because they say so. So she's like, so why don't they just print money and not inflate it? And of course you can't do that, but she didn't understand that. And she was kind of asking that question. And the way she presented the question was, it wasn't really as a question, but she did start it out by saying, please explain this shit to me. And the internet just went wild insulting her. Like, oh, you're such an idiot. You don't understand inflation. And it's like she started out asking for somebody to explain this to her. She understands that fiat is bullshit. Like, it costs the same amount to produce both a 20 and a 50. So that's already a pretty important point that most people, I don't think, understand. She just didn't understand in inflation. So I'm like, so all these people are now building this wall in between them and her, like, oh, she's an idiot, when the reality is, no, she's halfway there. Someone teach her the other half. Like, and then she could be a great ally to you know, inflation or socialism or whatever, you know, whatever the issue exactly is.
So for your point on, you know, the divide with Bernie Sanders and, you know, the socialist base in this country, I actually think there's a great bridge for people who identify as Bernie supporters or Gabbard supporters to actually come over and support some more free market policy. And I actually think Andrew Yang is a great example of how that bridge exists. So an example of where I'm actually, you know, less libertarian, if you want to use that word, than others is I actually do believe in a strong social safety engine in this country. Is it UBI? Not necessarily, because I think there are some budget issues with that. I've proposed, then, you know, like I said, when I say propose, there's a lot of math left to be done on this, and I don't want to say this is a definite, but an idea. I would do a program more in the lines of Social Security 360, where it is a combination of trying to actually move towards a more privatized Social Security model with 401k accounts and Roth IRA. But then at the same time, we do have a UBI component of it, and it's based on income. And it's also similar to Milton Friedman's negative income tax model. So I believe the proposal was about $1,000 a month, to just keep it at the Yang proposal. And if you make $30,000 a year, you get $500 a month cash, but then you also get $500 a month put into your 401k account. And the goal is to actually build on interest with that. And the model is, you know, we try to get everyone about $1.3 to $2.5 million in savings by the time they turn 65. And I actually think that we can do that with youth as well. I believe in a model where instead of giving money for free college, I don't support universal college, but I support the idea of, you know, let's give every single child in this country or person under the age of 18, you know, $1,500 to $2,500 a year, put that in a 401k account for them, have it so that they get $75,000 to $120,000 by the time they're 18, and put some rules on that. Say, hey, use it only for education, use it only for housing. And if you don't want to do those two things with it, you can collect half of the interest payment on that. But that is something that I believe would actually end poverty in America. And it's something that wouldn't actually be that expensive. I did some basic math on it, and it would cost only about one third of what universal college would. And I actually think it's something that is much more preferable to lower income Americans. You know, I talked to people, I went to a high school where I want to say 80% of the student body was, you know, using assisted lunch programs. There wasn't a lot of money in Monticello. And, you know, college wasn't really an option, even if it was free, because some of these communities and some of these families, they need to work. Or some of them, they don't want to go to a four-year school. They want to go to a trade school. They want to get a job, an apprenticeship. And I think, you know, the free college idea is biased against that. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can actually communicate with the hard left and say, hey, we support, you know, a model to end poverty, but we have to do it in a way where it's actually pro-people and not just anti-Jeff Bezos. And that's another thing where I think the left is actually very wrong, and I think libertarians and conservatives are right. Regulation is, you know, just to put it bluntly, bullshit. I think the minimum wage is a failure. I think Davis-Bacon Act is a failure. I think, you know, our rules against nuclear power and our laws against it have prevented us from what could have been the greatest economic miracle in the last 50 years, where we could be paying vastly less for energy right now. And we don't do it because of, you know, just, you know, burdensome regulation, where I think it was big oil that, you know, waged a war on nuclear. So I think there's actually a lot of laws and a lot of regulations that we can cut and get rid of and improve the economy this, you know, that way. But I also think we can learn a lot from the left as well, in, you know, the fact that people are struggling, and we can reform our social safety net and our spending to actually produce a better model. And that's what I'm about, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely interesting that you bring that out. And you know, something I do compliment the left on all the time is their accuracy of pointing out part of the problem, which is that, you know, life is not supposed to be easy, right? That's I mean, we still live in the world. The world is rough. Life is not perfect, but it shouldn't be as hard as it is. And the reason that we have that is we're forced into a system where we're forced to work 40 hours a week, maybe 60 hours a week, for until we're 60 or 70. And then we're supposed to retire, and then we're too sick to enjoy our lives. And I think they're absolutely right to point out things like there is no living wage. So many people are working so hard and they can barely pay their rent. They have to spend their entire income only to end up in debt and all these other problems. And yes, there are some government programs out there that are supposed to save us from this, but ultimately these are just the problems. The solutions that they have, like the UBIs and the safety nets and all these other things, I think are inherently flawed because they don't actually fix the problem. It's kind of like this. If you have a, let's say you cut your hand, right? And you're bleeding and you're getting blood all over the floor. Well, yeah, there's a problem that there's blood all over the floor. So is the solution to put down a bucket so there's no blood on the floor? Or do you take care of the wound on your hand so you can stop bleeding? And I think that's where the critical difference is in between the Bernie Sanders ideologies or the Andrew Yang's ideologies and some of the things that I've been proposing, which are more about putting people on a solid foundation where they're not being taxed. So, for example, you know, a lot of people believe that home ownership in the United States is the highest it's ever been. I think it's like 60-something percent right now. And that's because of the FHA and all these other things. The reality is nobody owns their property because even after you've paid it off, you're still paying property tax. And a lot of people go into retirement with their Social Security only being able to pay their property tax. Some people aren't able to buy a home by the time they retire, and so they're stuck paying rent. And when they get their Social Security check, most of that goes to rent. But even so, you have most people buy their first home when they're about 33 years old with a 30-year loan. So that house isn't even paid off until you're getting ready to retire. And when you compare this to the system that Mexico has, and Mexico's far from perfect, I realize that, but spending a lot of time down here, I see a lot of the way things work down here. They have 80% home ownership. And of those 80% of the entire population, none of those people are in debt on their homes. It's not, people buy their homes cash here. Because of that, the prices are much lower. There's no inheritance tax. So if you die, you give your house to your heirs. The property tax is fractional. It's very, very, very small compared to what the United States is. A lot of people, there's a lot of land where people can just go squat and start building their homes, which is pretty much outlawed in the United States. And we're talking about entire communities where, like, you know, there are roads, like, granted, they're dirt roads, but of course, you know, this is just what I've seen in the area that I'm in. Dirt roads in the jungle where people can go and squat and, you know, take off like a 20 by 20 meter area, which is a pretty good size area for a nice size house and a nice yard. And they can just start building and they don't have to worry about rent or property tax or any of this other stuff. And because of all of this stuff, I mean, think about how much money we waste. America's biggest expense is their rent. So you're working a job and all of your money's going towards rent. And then we have this concept. Well, okay, we're gonna tax the rich so that we can subsidize because they're already living so well. But what you're doing then is you're forcing these people who are close to retirement, you're forcing them to work harder to save up some money so they can retire, so because they want to retire well, which means you're forcing them to stay in the employment pool for longer, which means they're competing with everybody else for jobs. Imagine this. Imagine, especially as jobs are being replaced by automation, imagine everybody says, well, hey, I've saved up everything. I own my house. I've got a little piece of land. If shit hits the fan, I've got enough land to grow food on. Everything's taken care of. I've got savings. I'm good. I'm going to retire and I'm only 40. And now now my job opens up for somebody else. So somebody else who might be 25 or 30 gets to move up to a higher position, and the entry level people are able to get paid more for their jobs because there's fewer people competing. So many of these things could be fixed simply by counterintuitively removing some of these safety net programs that are actually doing more harm than good.
So a few things I want to comment on that. So first off, I actually do agree with you for the most part on property taxes. I'm for the income tax existing. I'm for, you know, a flattened down income tax, very few deductions, if any. And I don't want to say necessarily flat tax. I'm okay with, you know, some people paying higher rates. But I don't think property taxes necessarily work that well. I don't think, you know, corporate taxes work either. And I think, you know, corporate taxes make up about 8% of America's tax revenue every year. I think we should work on a model to phase that out during the next decade. And if we did that, there would be an economic boom from it. I think payroll taxes, you know, corporate taxes, you know, let's, you know, scale down spending growth, and let's also maybe increase income taxes and move into that model where we're going to have more. Regarding the concept of wealth building, though, you know, that's definitely something I'm talking about with the idea of trying to move to a model like Social Security 360, where we do the UBI plan, we do, you know, some replacements to our current social safety net, but we have an emphasis on savings and, you know, owning part of the economy with it, because there's, you know, there are people out there where, you know, they're lower income and they're not saving a dime. And if they were just to save, you know, $100 a month, you know, $200 a month over the course of 10, 20 years, they could be living vastly better than what they're currently living in. So my model is, you know, I think that we actually can do generational wealth building through Social Security 360, and we could get it so families do have, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in 401k accounts that are locked in for them. And they could be, you know, off of, you know, dividends, off of returns, you know, living well through that. And that could be a strong economy. Regarding property taxes, though, I've done a little bit of research on this. You know, I haven't looked at Mexico's housing, so I'm going to just say that very clearly. But housing in America, so price per square foot compared to 1970, the price per square foot has actually dropped a little bit because houses are actually larger now. I believe it was 2,000 square feet versus 1,400 in 1970. And then if we were to adjust interest rates on the, because interest rates were about, I want to say 120, 150% higher in 1970 versus now. So if you were to actually pay a house down, you know, 10, 20% when you buy and have to pay the remaining 80 to 90% over the course of 20 years, you'd actually be paying about, you know, maybe 10 to 30% more. I'd have to look back at my notes, but you'd be paying more money actually per square foot versus now. So I actually do think the economy has improved for a lot of people. I mean, I did the same thing with cars. If you look at auto loans, interest rates on those, and then how long cars last, and also mileage on cars, cars are actually much cheaper now versus 50 years ago. But the thing is, we have an economy that works very well with technology. We don't have an economy that's working very well with other things, land being one of them. I think zoning laws is responsible. Look at Houston, Texas versus New York City. New York City has the ability to make rent cheap. There's Staten Island, there's Queens, there's Brooklyn, there's downtown Manhattan. They don't get built up that easily. And because of that, it is hurting our economy. I also do think, you know, you make a great point about how, you know, these programs that are designed to help actually end up hurting. And one thing I've been a proponent of in New York City is the idea that people who live in public housing, why are we just, you know, taking money from them and they're just, you know, basically being tenants to us? Why don't we start making them owners where the money that they're paying is going to give them equity in the homes? If we were to have done that with the Bronx and done it with Harlem and done it with Queens years ago, we would have made these people owners in those properties and they would be millionaires right now. And, you know, there would have been some government subsidy to it, but we would have had no gentrification problem in New York City. These people would have walked off millionaires. And it's an amazing thing that could have happened and we missed the opportunity on it. And I also do think with the welfare state at hand, you know, when it comes to welfare in this country, you know, Whoopi Goldberg actually said it best because she said, you know, I was a single mother. I used public assistance. And why is it that when I was trying to save money and also work a job, they were penalizing me in the welfare system? So we need a social safety engine, not a social safety net, because the net is trapping in, you know, millions of people. And they're staying there longer than they have to, and they're not getting out of poverty. We need to actually really reform that system. And, you know, I don't think Andrew Yang's 100% right on UBI. I think he's oversimplified things. And also, by the way, you know, you brought up cutting your hands and, you know, bleeding versus the bucket. I actually think deregulation is our bandage. I think that we could have nuclear power. We could have better immigration models. I also think we need better schools. I think the biggest problem in our economy right now is we have an education system where we subsidized degrees that weren't very good to get a job. We made it too easy to get, you know, this, you know, college degree that doesn't have a tremendous market value, and now you have to pay $100,000 for it. And then at the same time, we also had a model where our high schools, you know, our high schools are, you know, government. They're one size does not fit all on education. We should be having school choice so schools, high schools, can tell parents, hey, we teach coding here. Hey, we teach, you know, engineering here. Hey, we teach finance here, and create a better product for our kids. Because, you know, I went to high school and I didn't think it was the best product. I was like, I learned more on my own from watching YouTube videos than I did about, you know, things. And I don't want to, you know, the teachers were great, the students were great, the faculty was great, but they don't have to compete. They're not given the best model. So we need a lot of reforms in this country to help poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I want to point out too, and I don't know the details about this system entirely, but instead of a social security program down here in Mexico, they do have something where so instead of setting up a retirement fund for you, the government actually helps you purchase a home where if you have a certain low income, they'll buy the house for you. You make payments to them. And it's some kind of program like that. So what's interesting about that is, yeah, so, cause they're helping you to actually build wealth instead of, you know, helping you to, like, you know, pad their bankrupt social security program.
Yeah. And government, like, here's the thing, this is something where I think, like, this is one of those things where, like, you know, to get into the topic of, you know, do libertarians go radical? I think the libertarians and Libertarian Party, they've had a lot of wins. Like, they've had a lot of things they're right on. You know, gay marriage, they were right on. Marijuana, they're right on. Social Security, the budget deficit. You know, there's 50 years of being right. But the problem, you know, you mentioned early on with, like, you know, Bernie Sanders people, they're half right on stating the problem, but then they get the solution wrong. I think libertarians are very simple, where they get the solution, they get the problem correct. They get the solution half right, but then the issue is they go to an extreme. I'm not for eliminating Social Security, but yeah, it's bankrupt. It's not going to work. And if you were to factor in how much money people put into Social Security versus what a 401k account could be, it's not comparable. We could have a generation right now where, you know, everybody has, you know, over $750,000 to $1 million in savings that they could pass on to their kids. And we're not doing it because we've run a Social Security program that I don't think was ever designed to work like this. And it's amazing that I think, you know, Mexico and Chile might actually have the US beat in how to model it.
Right. Yeah. And I criticize the libertarians all the time, especially on that. And so here's my thing. I think I'm pretty radical myself. And of course, I think I'm right.
I'm not radical. And I also think I'm right, too. So here we go.
So I do realize, like, you know, a lot of people want to just pull the plug. And I understand that's the completely wrong answer for two reasons. One, nobody's ever going to support that. The people who depend on that system are never going to support that. They're never going to let you anywhere near that system to pull the plug. And so that's, one, it's the wrong message. Two, it's the wrong plan. I guess that's why it's the wrong message. And it's the wrong plan, because if you ever do get into that position and you pull the plug, there are so many people, let's say Social Security, for example. If you were to pull the plug on that overnight, what's going to happen is there are a lot of people who are completely unprepared. You're going to have seniors who now have no income. They're not able to go back to work. You're going to create a lot of problems for a lot of people. Now, yes, I will say this system never should have been created in the first place, because it's literally stealing. It's a Ponzi scam. It's a Ponzi scheme. But if you were to pull the rug out from under people, there are going to be a lot of people who are upset. There are going to be a lot of people who, I mean, we've seen what can happen this year with people getting out and protesting and rioting. that's going to happen as well. If you just eliminate programs like this overnight, you're going to have people who don't have jobs, who don't have money, who don't have food. They have nothing to lose, and they're going to get out and they're going to fight like this. And then everyone's going to just come along and say, well, we tried the libertarian way. We tried getting rid of all these programs, and look what happened. And so I think, you know, so for that reason, it's the wrong message and it's the wrong plan. We need to have, I would say, I know we disagree on this. I would say get rid of the program completely. But at the same time, I would say we need to transition people into another program. And the program you mentioned, like, for example, I have nothing wrong with 401ks. If we got people to invest in 401ks, which I would say don't need to be 401ks, because the purpose of a 401k is that you don't have to pay income tax on it. So if you don't have income tax, then you don't need a 401k. But to get people to invest into some sort of savings and retirement, to get people to invest and build their own wealth, to own their own home and own their own property, that's the type of thing that I could see. And, you know, to the point of the 401ks being better than Social Security, I think that's got a lot to do with government is in control of Social Security. I mean, Social Security is an investment system, right? Like you've got your 401k and you've got Social Security. They're the same thing. You put money in it, it's supposed to grow, and then when you retire, you take money out. The difference is one is managed by the private sector and one is managed by the government. The private sector is investing in whatever they can to earn you bigger returns. The public sector, the Social Security, is investing in one thing and one thing only, treasury bonds. And basically giving the money to the government so the government can spend it with the promise of taxing it from somebody else later. So with that in mind, you know, I think there's...
And by the way, they're not even doing the bonds anymore. They're just giving people, you know, what's left over and putting that as the funds. It's a disaster. And it's never going to work out. And so, I mean, here's the thing. There was once a video I saw on YouTube about 10 years ago where they didn't, you know, they showed a dartboard, and they were asking people to, like, you know, put randomly on the dartboard and say, and they found that for Social Security, pretty much every form of investment you could imagine outperformed Social Security where there was the money involved. And it's something that's, I think there are ways, you know, I think there are the ideas of having very conservative investments. But and that's also why I went to the model of saying, hey, I think there's a UBI component to this in case there ever was a very bad year for the market. But now regarding what you're saying about, you know, programs, so I actually 100% agree with you on, you know, the idea we need to cut spending or, you know, need to reform these programs and, you know, replace them with new things, because there is the phase out model. And just one example, I think the spending is absolutely horrible with our government. I think there's a lot of paper pushers out there. I think there's a lot of, you know, soldiers who don't need to be soldiers anymore. And one thing I think we should do is, because if we were to fire them, we'd fire millions of people. We lay off millions of people. We can't do that. But I think we should just, you know, go to, you know, the federal workforce and say, hey, we're going to offer the best severance package ever. We're going to offer something like 3 to 5 years salary up front. Here you go. And you just, you know, no longer are working. Go do something else with your life. Go, you know, go get retrained, go find a new job, go enjoy yourself, and you're out. And I guarantee you, we would not even have to have any involuntary layoffs, because I think the people who would, I think a lot of people would just take that deal and leave right away. In fact, I believe 30% of the federal workforce is over the age of 55. So we're already in a position where, you know, 1 in 3 people who are working for the government on the federal level, they are, you know, already there at a point they could retire. So, you know, we could early retire these people, and, you know, we could actually walk off in a situation where government spending on an employee front, that can go down 10-20% overnight, and it wouldn't actually take, you know, anyone to complain. And, you know, I think there are actually reforms for how we could look at, you know, Medicare, for example, or Social Security, do programs like this and actually, you know, get things to work better. And the big point of what I say for government is I'm not for no government. I'm not for no taxes, but I'm for the idea of, you know, why aren't we focused on trying to build a government that does very few things very well versus a government that does everything very poorly? Like, you know, look at Colorado, for example. I was there not that long ago, and, you know, Reason Magazine covered this. and I saw wild horses running through the state of Colorado. I'm from New York. We don't have wild horses here. And I was like looking, and I'm like, you know, that's beautiful to see. And I found out all the ranchers actually hated the horse situation, because it only takes the horse population about 4 years for it to double. And horses are going into ranchers' ranches, and they're like disturbing things. And the federal government had, you know, a code, 24,000 wild horses are supposed to be in Colorado on that land. And they have 56,000 horses now. And I'm just sitting there like, why is the federal government involved with how many horses should be in Colorado? That's Colorado. Like, let them do that. And I'm just sitting there like, you know, and by the way, you know, one of the biggest things I think, you know, libertarians are right on, they've been right on for years, and I think they could win if they went, you know, to these states and addressed it. I believe 70% of the state of Nevada is owned by the federal government.
Yep.
70% of Idaho is owned by the federal government. The West is owned by the federal government, and it shouldn't be. It should be owned by Nevada. It should be owned by the people. There should be a plan to go to Idaho, which is a state that has been financially struggling for years, and say, hey, you know, this is your land. We're going to get rid of the federal government's land in Idaho, and we're going to give it to every single citizen. And I also think it should be given to the citizens. I think it should be given to some Native Americans who, you know, they need, like, I think a reparation. And I also do think it should be given to the Black community as a reparation for slavery as well. I think we should cut up this land, you know, give these, you know, like deeds of ownership to it to people, and have them figure out better uses for it. And maybe, you know, let's set up some conservation rules to make sure, you know, the first thing they do is not chop down trees and, you know, destroy the land. But let's have a real plan like that, because the idea that, you know, there's 60,000 wild horses in Colorado that are actually disturbing the environment, and our government has no idea what to do with it, and they actually make it illegal to go out and try to do something, it's insane.
Right. Well, I would say this. I mean, you make the point that, you know, the government is too big. It's spending all this money on things it shouldn't. And, you know, why don't we focus on building a government that works for the people? And I think this fundamentally comes down to the issue that taxation is theft, because why does the government have the capacity to do all of this? Why does the government have so many employees? Why does the government have so much land? And, you know, as they say, nothing is yours if you can't defend it. Why does the federal government have so many people to be able to defend these millions of acres and claim that they're theirs? Whatever gave them the right to claim this land as theirs? Why does the government have all of these resources to do all these things, to create all these bad programs that are destroying lives, that are forcing people into poverty and hunger, that are forcing people from not just going to this land and taking it and homesteading it? Why does the government have that much power? And the answer is taxes. They don't have, you know, you look at Elon Musk. Is he doing anything really evil with all the billions of dollars that he has? What about Jeff Bezos? Is he really doing anything incredibly evil with that? Is he hiring armies to go around and steal from people? Is he creating regulations that are telling people they can't go homestead on this land over here, on these millions of unoccupied acres? No, it's the government that does that. Because why? Jeff Bezos, he has billions of dollars, but why would he invest in something like that? That doesn't make any sense. But here you have government. You have these crony corrupt politicians with an unlimited budget, trillions of dollars. And who's giving them that money? Well, you and I are. Well, we don't like what they're doing with it. Why don't we stop giving it to them? Why don't we give them less? We're not even allowed to give them less. If we give them less, we're in trouble. Why? Because that's the entire system. The entire system is based on theft. And if you don't stop theft, if you don't make every contribution that goes to, whether it's the state or federal government or local government, if you don't make every single contribution to that system completely voluntary, then you lose. Because think about it. If Jeff Bezos declared war against Israel, he's got enough money. He could hire an army and he could declare war against Israel. What's going to happen? People are going to boycott Amazon. They're going to cut off his funds, and he's not going to have any money to go to war with anybody. What happens when the United States wants to go to war with a family in Waco, Texas, or against an entire country in the Middle East. Nothing. Nobody can stop them, because at the end of the day, we're still giving them money. We have to, not only are they doing something that we morally oppose, we're being forced to pay for it. And so that is the main reason that we can't just say we have to cut it back. We have to stop the theft. We have to be able to put the power back in our hands to say, we don't like that program, we're not going to pay for it.
So I'm not for eliminating taxation, but I do think we need to have better rules in place on, you know, fact-checking our government. I actually believe we need to have strict rules for how much our government spends to GDP, and I think we need a constitutional amendment capping GDP to spending.
But who's going
to
make those rules?
Spending to GDP. I think that we need to have strict rules on how much spending growth can happen unless there is a war or some sort of emergency.
But who's going to make those rules?
A what?
But who's going to make those rules?
The government would have to, and we have... Well, here's the
same people who spend it. This is the exact same problem we have with the debt ceiling, where there's a debt ceiling that says you can never run the debt higher than this amount, and whenever they want to borrow, whenever they want to exceed that amount, they just vote to raise the debt, and now they can borrow more money and spend more.
They don't follow the rules well at all. And that's the point. We need to actually have good management of government. But there is the point of saying, you know, I could ask the question of who's going to eliminate all taxes, because, you know, eventually it gets to the point where we have to have a government reform no matter what. It just, you know, what are we trying to reform or fix there? So regarding the idea of, you know, balanced budget amendment, GDP caps, I'm for all of those. And I think that, you know, that's the measures we have to take to actually make government work better. Regarding the whole thing about, you know, just, you know, like, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, I'd rather have them have, you know, taxpayer money than, you know, the current government. And that's actually the biggest problem with the Bernie left. They run around and say that, you know, Jeff Bezos is the enemy. Jeff Bezos isn't the enemy. Jeff Bezos is the child of a single mom who went to, you know, form a company that's made things vastly cheaper, that saves the American people $50 to $100 billion a year. And it's also been environmentally friendly of a company, because they've actually worked to reduce, you know, the carbon pollutions from shipping, because they ship things better. So Amazon's an amazing company, and these companies are awesome. This war against capitalism, that's actually the big problem with the left, by the way. The left has this issue where I think they care more about the idea that people are wealthier than they are, versus actually helping people in poverty.
Right.
And it's a huge problem that they have, because I hear all these people who are, you know, like, you know, Bernie supporters or Warren supporters, they run around and say, well, you know, Zuckerberg has too much money, Warren Buffett has too much money. And I could care less how much money they have, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's not cash on hand. Jeff Bezos has $180 billion. Right. That's Amazon stock. If he ever tried to sell it, he wouldn't even get a third of that much money, which would still be a lot, but, you know, not as much as people think. If there ever was this thing where billionaires couldn't exist, they would not get 10% on the dollar. If there was a law, billionaires can't exist, they all have to sell their, you know, their stock or whatever. They would not get 10 cents on the dollar for what Right. they're valued at right now. That's just a fact. You know, what happens there is, you know, we have these people try to demonize, they're demonizing business. They're demonizing, you know, these people who've created these great things for the economy. I mean, Eric Yuan, who is the founder of Zoom, who, you know, I don't know him extremely well. He occasionally likes my Facebook post. I call him a good acquaintance. He created a great company, an example of what happens when you leave an oppressive state like China to come to a less oppressive state like America. And, you know, you build a company that changes the world and lets us have conversations like this. But then I just look at the left and, you know, there's so many things. They should be opposed to the government, because guess what? The government is the one that, you know, runs the police system that has the war on drugs. The government is the one that makes, you know, this public school system not work, and they're denying choice to their people. And by the way, the public school system is a civil rights issue, because, you know, I got to go to private school for 10 years of my life. And, you know, because my father was a doctor, my parents had cash, but all these people, you know, most people, their education is decided by their zip code, and they also have the government. You know, there's a lot of people on the left who, you know, they intentionally go out of their way to say, oh, yeah, no, we want better schools for lower income kids. But then the moment they get into those votes on the local level, they're the ones that say, well, we don't want this neighborhood in our school. We want it in that school, because that's the worst school. We don't want those kids in our school. So there's so much hypocrisy in the left when it comes to that. And we need to reform that. And, you know, the idea of, like, can we fix the government? I think that's ultimately the big question that the Libertarian Party's had for years. And it's, you know, it's been a big question in the Liberty Movement. Hell, I think it's, we're kind of skirting around to it. So is there an idea that the government could actually fix things and governmental actions are the best way to do it? You know, I believe that there's no other way that we can make that fix. I think that, you know, we've talked about options such as, you know, Bitcoin or seasteading or, you know, these other things as a hope that they could fix it. I don't think they'd really work. You know, honestly, I think the best company that actually helped fix the government a little bit, or at least, you know, go against the government, was actually Uber. Because, you know, for decades, there were the medallion monopolies in every city. They said, hey, you know, right. This is how many cabs can exist. This is who has the medallions. If you want to own your own cab, it's going to cost $1 million. And the first time I ever got exposed to that idea was watching a documentary by Walter Williams, rest in peace, great economist. And Dr. Williams in the 70s, he pointed out the difference between the Washington, D.C. cab industry versus the Philadelphia cab industry. And, you know, he said Washington, D.C. is very cheap to get a medallion to own your own cab. And that's why 80% of people in Washington, D.C. own cabs. And he also pointed out in Washington, D.C., you can actually, you know, be parked. You can hold up, you know, a sign saying, you know, like cabs or whatever here. And people can come to you versus Philadelphia, New York City, where it's extremely expensive to get a medallion. And then at the same time, they could only drive around and people would have to call out and they could stop for them. So that's insane. The idea we had that much regulation and it was hurting, you know, people in poverty. And, you know, I had some issues with Walter Williams, especially in the last decade, where I think, you know, he kind of sided a little bit too much with some craziness. But that was a great documentary, and I'd recommend for anyone listening to watch it. It was called State Against Blacks, and I believe it's on YouTube. It's 6 parts. Give it a watch.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, and, you know, I think this is, you know, you mentioned about the left that a lot of these guys have these really great talking points, and then they get elected, and then they don't deliver on those. And I think a lot of that, we see that with you know, with the police. Like, the Democrats are usually the people who side with minorities and lower income families, but the police generally, with the war on drugs and everything else, they generally patrol neighborhoods with lower income more. That's generally where they you know, even though people with higher income use drugs at the same rate, the people with lower income are the ones who are profiled, arrested, harassed, and all this other stuff. And the Democrats are, you know, the people who are for the minorities, and they're for, you know, the little guy, and they're for injustice, you know, protecting people from injustice and all this other stuff. But ultimately, it's the Democrats who are funneling more money into the police unions than anybody else. And so, you know, we see the same thing with, you know, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden coming out and saying, like, oh yeah, we're gonna protect people from this police misconduct, and we're gonna do, you know, all these reforms, and we're gonna end the drug war and all this other stuff. When Biden created the
Trump was better for criminal justice than Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Exactly.
Were. Donald Trump wasn't even that great.
It's almost like the Democrats are like they're creating these plans and selling them so they can create more problems so they can sell the solution, which is just like, you know, that's like the mechanic that you take your car to and, like, yeah, he changes your oil, but then he pulls one of your spark plug cables out so that you have to bring it back and say, oh, something else isn't working now, and they got to fix something else.
Well, for criminal justice reform, I'm also just going to say it, like, you know, like, okay, I believe in the slogan, you know, Black Lives Matter. Black lives do matter. And, you know, 100% happy to, you know, help them with reforms in education, economics, and, you know, criminal justice. I don't necessarily agree with, you know, all the reforms they proposed and have my own, but that's a different discussion. But I think the big slogan should be, you know, poor lives matter, because, you know, we always discuss these problems, like, you know, is this a Black problem or is this an everyone problem? I actually think it's a problem for people in poverty, because if you're a wealthy person in this country, if you make over $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year, and you get busted for cocaine or marijuana, you're not getting in trouble. Your parents will get you the right lawyer, and you get community service. If you're making under 25 grand a year, you get busted for that, you're going to jail for 3 years. And that's what the big, you know, thing is. You know, I mean, because I remember looking at this, the African-American community gets sentenced to 23% longer for the same crimes as white people. But then if we factor in the community of people who make under $50,000 to $75,000 a year, they get, you know, sentenced, I believe it was something in the realm of, you know, 300% more time. Like they get their sentences are 300% longer. And also their rate of, you know, innocence versus conviction is not even comparable. So those things, that's where we need to also reform the criminal justice system. And I actually believe one great reform we should make on our legal system is actually creating a curve policy when it comes to sentencing for minorities and then also for lower income people, where we begin to actually look and say, hey, why were white people sentenced 25% less than black people? And we're going to start lowering the sentences of black people for, you know, the crimes on that front. So there's so much going wrong with criminal justice. And I also think Kamala Harris is actually, you know, like I supported Biden over Trump, but I, you know, Kamala Harris, it was a disaster. If he picked any other VP, I think he would have actually had a decisive victory over Trump. And she is something where she is, you know, we talk about this idea of like, you know, what is wrong with Washington? And I don't think it's Joe Biden. I don't necessarily think it's Donald Trump. It's Kamala Harris. It's the people who will say anything to get elected, and they show no principle at all. Kamala Harris was one of the worst prosecutors and worst attorney general in America during the 2010s. She sent people to jail. She was going to let a man die, and the Supreme Court had to intervene against him, and thankfully they kicked her ass on it. And then what happened was the moment she becomes a senator and she sees the win, she's like, oh, I could run in 2020, and oh, criminal justice reform's popular now. She no longer is the tough prosecutor. She's for everybody. And the moment that Kamala Harris sees it, Kamala Harris was a moderate, and she's like, oh, well, Bernie's popular, so I'm going to become a bigger socialist than he is. And she actually proposed more spending than Bernie Sanders did, if that's even possible. And then the moment that, you know, that's no longer a thing, she's like, oh, I like Joe Biden. I entertained the idea he could have been a rapist and a racist a year ago, but now I like him. And she becomes vice president of the United States. And that's something where, you know, we're going to have to fight to keep people like her out. Like, you know, Donald Trump said, drain the swamp. But, you know, I don't think Joe Biden's the swamp. I think Joe Biden is a guy who's a decent person that's confused on issues. I think Kamala Harris is the actual swamp and the epitome of what's wrong with Washington.
Right. With that, we're getting towards the end of the show, and I mean, we could keep talking about this for hours. This is actually...
I could bash Kamala Harris for 10 hours straight.
Yeah, on that issue alone. Yeah, I want to give you an opportunity, just if there's anything, if anyone's interested in you, they want to find out more about you or what you're working on, or if there's anything that you want to plug, I just want to give you a few minutes to go ahead and... Sure. And
Oh, we're cutting out?
No.
Oh, we cut out there. Sorry about that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, happy to do some plugs. So on TikTok, it's Charles Peralo, P-E-R-A-L-O. Also Facebook right now. I'm setting up a website and a newsletter. Don't have it up just yet. But Facebook, you know, if anyone wants to just follow me there, I write posts on business every day. I don't do as much political posts, even though tomorrow I am writing about Biden's Health and Human Services Secretary pick. Going to give a solid meh on that guy. Nothing good, nothing bad. You know, the final thing I'd just like to say is that, first off, Dan, thanks for having me. I know we disagree on some stuff in the Liberty universe, but it is always nice to have these conversations and see how, in the grand scheme of things, I think we agree more than we disagree. But the final thing I'd like to say is, you know, just kind of a message for kind of the Liberty movement, which is, you know, I think that from talking to a lot of people and from being able to, I think, get more synergy and more agreements with conservatives and liberals versus, you know, some people in the LP, I think that there is, you know, a lot of work and a lot of success the Libertarian Party and the Liberty Movement can have. But, you know, right now, I think they're looking for hundreds in terms of what they want to agree with them. I think if they go for an 80, they are going to have a lot of success. It's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like they were right on the Libertarian Party was right on gay marriage, right on marijuana, right on the budget issues, right on Social Security. But I think they took things a little too far on all those issues, and they don't necessarily get the credit that I feel they deserve. And I think, you know, just coming down a little bit and just, you know, being willing to work with people a little more, there's going to be some great things to happen there. And I guess the final thing is, you know, final thing I'll say before I leave, I don't think taxation is theft, but taxation, when it goes to a lot of things it goes to, is definitely unnecessary and is wrong of what's happening.
So let me ask you this question.
All right.
If
final one,
let's say, okay, just real quick, give me one thing that you think if a tax paid for it, it would not be theft.
NASA. I think that the idea that we have, I think the idea of investing in science is a great thing. And I think that we should actually work to take our military and convert the money there to curing diabetes, cancer, HIV. I think the Human Genome Project and NASA are proof that we can do that within the next decade. And it would massively help our economy. Like, curing Alzheimer's should be our moon mission this decade.
Okay, so real quick, if a tax for NASA is not theft, but if you get sick and you have a medical bill, or you lose your job and you need to buy food, and the government is telling you that you need to pay a tax, and you have to decide between paying that tax or buying your food or paying for your medicine, and if pay for your medicine or food instead of paying the tax, you go to jail. Is that theft?
If the government is taxing people one penny who are making under $50,000 a year, I think that's wrong. I think government, you know, look, I'm not for someone who wants to penalize wealthy people. It's not my thing. But I don't believe that people who are lower income and struggling should be paying, taxes. And I also do not believe that, look, you know, it's one of those things where I believe we should help the poor and we should help lower income people. If someone's making $1 million a year, they benefited from some government roads. They benefited from workers who are publicly, like, you're educated. They benefit from a safe country that's, you know, through our military and not, you know, oppressed by China or Russia. I believe there is some taxes to be paid. Not a lot of taxes, but some. And I don't think the taxation... But for someone who has a medical bill, if someone is struggling with cancer and their government is trying to charge them taxes, and, you know, that's the situation, that is completely wrong, and I do not support that.
Awesome. Well, and I like what you just said, too. Anybody making under $50,000 should not pay a penny in tax. And I think we can definitely agree on that as a starting point. And yeah, I think no. Also that's a really good point that you said, too. If it shouldn't matter how much you made. If you have a life or death emergency or anything, and you have to pay that instead of your taxes, and the government's going to harass you for it, then let's make an exemption for that too. Those are both great starting points.
Here's the thing. You know, the whole point of, like, you know, conversations that I like about this is that, look, you know, I'm not the kind of guy to go out and say taxation is theft. I'm not the type of guy to go out and say let's get rid of the government. But I think there's a proper medium between, you know, viewpoints like yours and viewpoints like what exists in Washington, where I think you make a lot of, you know, correct points, and I think they actually make something as well. So I like to kind of be the referee in between it and get a system that I think we can all be comfortable with, at least for a while. We might want to change some things down the road, or they might want to. But, you know, I think if we can get to a point where everybody says, hey, this isn't what I wanted, but I like this better than what I had before, I think that's a great achievement to have.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, Charles, it's been great having you on. Definitely like to have you back sometime and talk some more about this. And of course, everybody listening, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, even if you didn't, click like and share and subscribe and follow and do all that great stuff. Check out the next episodes that are coming up. And don't forget to help us out by heading over to taxationistheft.info. We're actually giving away something. It looks kind of like an AR-15, but it's not. But if you want to sign up, we're giving it away for free. Just go to taxationistheft.info and look for the free giveaway there. And of course, anything you do to support us on that page, whether you're buying a hat or a t-shirt, it all goes to help our counter propaganda campaign that is working to end taxation around the world. And of course, you know, as we had Charles on the show today, and he does not believe that all taxation is theft, this is a living example, this conversation that we had right here, of how you can actually have an adult conversation with somebody who you don't agree with. You can learn something from them. You can come to some middle ground agreement of a stepping stone to head in the direction of what you believe is the right societal change that we need to go to. And this is all important and necessary if we're ever going to get anywhere, if we ever want to see any real progress towards a better life for this country or for this world. This is the direction we have to go, because if we're just throwing insults at each other, we're not listening, and we're just fighting, we're never going to get anywhere. We're just going to continue to divide ourselves. And that's what we got with this last election, and this is why this country is so divided right now. So if we need to fight against anything, we need to fight against that. We need to come together, and we need to have these kinds of discussions. So again, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time on Taxation is Theft.